Did you know 38% of Ohio's teenagers have spent money on gambling in video and online games? Items like mystery boxes, skins, and spin to win mimic gambling, putting children at a higher risk of experiencing a gambling disorder as an adult. So get in the know about youth gambling and start the conversation with discussion guides, parent resources, and more at changethegameohio.org. That's changethegameohio.org.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to accomplished UK fund manager Dominic Weller of Octopus Investments. So welcome, Dominic.
Good morning, Paul. Excited to be here. First time.
So yeah, well, it's great to have you on the show. We've got lots of big macro news coming up over the next month, not least the inauguration of Donald Trump. Got plenty of UK trading updates over the next few weeks and the kickoff of the US earnings season at the back end. But before we sort of like run through all that, I'd just like to say a big shout out to our sponsor today, Edison Investments. They do some marvelous coverage of UK, European and US stocks, which is freely available for all investors. I mean, I've used it for a lot, very often over the last 25 years. I don't know whether you ever see the research at all, Dominic.
Yeah, no, I get it. And I met Borussia Dortmund with Edison, my favourite club, so that was quite exciting.
Oh, did you? Borussia, of course, yes, they cover them out in Europe, don't they, in Germany?
Exactly right.
Okay, fabulous. So, yeah, great. Okay, good. Well, I don't suppose you could just quickly introduce yourself in terms of what type of investor you are and what kind of stocks you like.
Cool, of course, yeah. No, thank you for having me on. I am working at Octopus Investments within their creative franchise. We run about $2 billion. A lot of it is in small mid-caps, and we run that through a range of different funds. We have a micro-cap growth fund run by Richard Power, where Chris McVeigh, who's been on your show many times, and I support him. We've got a multi-cap income fund, which looks to deliver superior growth and income, which Chris runs and Richard and I support. And then we have a future generations fund, which is a multi-cap strategy investing in three key investment themes, which are building a sustainable planet, empowering people, and revitalizing healthcare. So I lead that, and I'm supported by Richard and Chris on that one. So that's essentially our setup. We also have two venture capital trusts where we get to know businesses at a very early stage, often pre-IPO, and that is an amazing seedbed of ideas for a lot of additional funds. So quite a lot of companies we talk about, we got to know at a very, very early stage, I think. In terms of our portfolio construction, we use a core satellite approach. So 75% in core companies and 25% in satellites, which are smaller, exciting, sort of binary, more typically binary opportunities, or still just smaller in what they're doing. In terms of what types of investors I am, or an investor I am, I would say I'm a investor looking for value-creating growth. What I mean by that, growth, I think, is really, really important in the long term to compound. But growth, depending on the business model, can be worth a lot, or it can be worth nothing, or it could destroy value. So I place a lot of focus on understanding those dynamics, and I then want to buy these companies at attractive prices. In terms of what our core companies typically look like, they'll be profitable, they'll be solving an important problem, they'll have a competitive advantage in what they're doing, really strong gross margins typically, ability to reinvest is really important for us because it gives that our growth runway, and we like sort of very strong balance sheets and cash generation. So that's a very brief, fast run through of what I believe and sort of look for typically in businesses, especially in the core businesses.
Yeah, well, you've got quite a few characteristics, actually. I like those as well, but they're not always easy to find, are they? And we've certainly got a great selection. got a great selection of companies to run through. And if anybody would like to ask Dominic some questions, then please put them in the chat box. I'll see if we've got some coming through already. But before we get to that, what is your sort of outlook for these sort of like, you know, futures type of investments, ones with sort of like strong growth, high gross margins, decent balance? What's the sort of the outlook for 2025? Because certainly in the small and mid cap, a lot of them have been battered actually in the last 2 years.
Yeah, well, I'm a firm believer that flows are super important. And I think flows have had a very strong impact on the UK market. I mean, you just need to look at the numbers over the last sort of years. You've had persistent outflows, which is just very difficult to sort of stem. Hence, you get a lot of cheap takeovers of businesses. And I think it's absolutely important to change that flow environment and get allocators allocating back to the UK. And I think that is what is going to determine ultimately what the valuations are going to do. I think it's fair to say that sort of more long duration assets in the UK have had a slightly harder time throughout the interest rate hiking cycle that we went through. And so as that hopefully comes to an end, that I think is a positive as well. We should have political stability in the UK. We'll have it in the US. And so it's a really interesting environment, I think. The valuations, as you talked about, are really attractive by and large. And we enter a period where the entry point could be really quite exciting and the picture sort of shifting to the positive. So I'm really quite excited for 2025. We're going to get a lot of trading updates. And yeah, I think it'll be really, really interesting. And I think either of two things will happen is we'll see flows return and valuations adjust, or we're going to have a persistence of takeover activity. I really think so, because just the valuation disconnect is just too strong for comparable assets in the UK.
Yeah, I would totally agree. Actually, there's a famous expression by the late Charlie Munger. He says, to be a good investor, you need to fish where the fish are swimming. But to be a great investor, you need to fish where there's no fishing boats. And I actually think UK small caps is where there are absolutely no fishing boats at the moment. So I hope he's right this time. Okay, let's take a question. We got one from Lemon Physical. He's asking about a company at hold. It's called Boku, which is a mobile payments carrier billing on the sort of telcos. But won a sort of like, according to Lemon Physical, a sort of landmark contract with Amazon out in Japan. How do you see this business? Because the margins and the growth have been absolutely off the charts of late.
It's a company that IPO'd in 2017, and we first got involved with our microcap fund, so have known it for a really long time. Initially, it was very focused on direct carrier billing, so especially in emerging markets. So in those markets where you've got very little bank account penetration or potentially a credit card penetration, merchants, or big frontier merchants, wanted to use direct carrier billing to reach those consumers. So the good and the great of the FANGs are customers of Boku in that space. And it's been quite successful in this direct carrier billing space. It's a win-win really for the merchants, because they get customers that they don't have, plus you get them at a significantly lower take rate than typically a credit card would charge. And that has been sort of the backbone of Boku. It also had an identity business, which is sold a few years ago to Twilio, and focused on a new growth area, and that is wallets. So if you go to Asia and travel to Vietnam or any of the other countries, you'll typically use a mobile wallet like Grab or super app like Grab. And those wallets often are the first introduction to the financial system for a lot of consumers in those markets. And equally, just like direct carrier billing, it's an incredibly attractive way, but really difficult way for merchants to charge from. So that's where Boku has built a really strong market, has been executing really strong growth, direct account to account, which is working incredibly well as well now in those markets, where if you buy in a shop, you could just transfer the money directly to the to the owner of the shop, which is which doesn't really happen here. We would have the technology for it, but it doesn't happen. But that is an additional potential leg of growth. And so Boku is really exposed to that long-term growth of digital transactions and in those markets. And I think a lot of these markets potentially won't really get credit cards in the same sense, or the adoption will be relatively lower because there's not particular incentive from the merchants to take credit card payments versus local payment methods. And for the consumers, they potentially get credit products in a different way. So it's really, I think it's a really interesting asset. I mean, there was a, I think it's really well positioned going forward. It's done very well. It's super high margin business, obviously. It's got rocks on the balance sheet. And I think it's a really exciting company in the UK. And it's been one of sort of the really exciting growth stories that we've had.
Yeah, it's got a rock solid balance sheet as well. It's got about $120 million of cash and makes 33%.
Not all of that is their cash. So some right. of it will be, but they have a very, very strong balance sheet. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it looks a terrific business. If anybody wants to have a bit more of a dig. Yeah, now if everybody wants a bit more of a dig into the actual into the company, then have a look at Edison's research on it, because I'll just put it up here. There's a lady who covers them. What is it? It's basically Catherine Thompson, who I know actually personally. She's a very good IT and software analyst, and it's showing sort of 10% top line growth there. So a lot more details there if anybody wants to have a look. In terms of their competition, I noticed another company in your portfolio at the other end is Wise, which is obviously listed, a much bigger company listed on the LSE probably about 3 or 4 years ago, done really well. It's more of a more, as I understand, it's more of a more peer-to-peer sort of like Forex international payments business, really sort of like attacking on the consumer side the likes of PayPal, but mainly undercutting the banks, I think, the big traditional players. How do you see Wise going forward? Because it's obviously done really well just of late.
Yeah, it's done really well. It came to market via, I think, an introduction, which was quite interesting at the time. And at the time, it was not really in our investment universe, and the shares did quite badly following their introduction. And one thing I do a lot is read investor letters. It's sort of a big part of my process. And there was a really good write-up by Andrew Rosenblum, who runs a fund called Bonsai Partners. And that sort of got me back into looking at Wise. I've been a user of it. I absolutely love it, having moved here from Europe. So it's a brilliant product for a consumer. But sort of got into it from the perspective of the investment case here. And fundamentally, I think this is a really, really well-positioned business to change the way money gets transferred internationally, as opposed to the really burdensome and difficult SWIFT system. Wise has established a network of bank accounts that they then move capital through really easily. This started as you say, as TransferWise, as a consumer business, and it has grown really nicely. Yeah, significantly lower fees, higher transparency, but they've started to plug banks in there as well, just because it's so much more competitive than the existing system, much faster, and they've got such exciting economies of scale in that business. So as you layer through more money flowing through this platform, the costs don't really go up for the company yet. And that's a dynamic that I think is what makes this company really, really interesting. And there was a company listed in the UK before which tried to do something similar. It was really quite difficult. That was called Earthport. I don't know if you remember it.
Yes,
but
I do,
ultimately
yeah.
you've got Yeah, ultimately, there was a bidding war with Visa and MasterCard over it, which just tried to establish something similar. But I think what Wise has done is really build the scale, which is absolutely critical in this market. They obviously are beneficiary from high interest rates as well. So from a portfolio construction perspective, where a lot of the companies that we have in the fund will be very strong beneficiaries from lower interest rates. This is sort of a nice natural hedge where if we are in a slightly higher for longer environment, it's quite sort of, from a portfolio construction perspective, it does a job there as well. So and you've got a fantastic management team, which is, I think, so aligned with shareholders to create a significantly bigger business. They really think about the long term and how to build a long-term company that creates a lot of value. And yeah, so I think a real jewel in the UK, something quite special. And it's great that it's on the UK market. I think it's outstanding. And one to look at. I mean, the shares have had a really, really strong run. I think we're going to get an update in a few days, in 10 days or so. So that's going to be an interesting one. But yeah, I think from a consumer perspective, it's brilliant. And also, I think as a investment case, it's really interesting.
Yeah, now it's gone up sort of like 70-80%, hasn't it, in about 3 months. Just in terms of that user, obviously you're a fabulous consumer to sort of being a German expat working in the UK, presumably transferring earned sterling into euros back to maybe the family or whatever it is in Germany to pay mortgages or whatever. So it ticks the boxes on the transfer. What about sort of spending, though, in terms of coverage? How do you... If I wanted to compete against the likes of PayPal, for instance, could I use it for merchants to buy things, or is it mainly just a straight transfer?
Well, you now have a full Wise bank account as well. So if you've got the Wise app, you can easily open currency accounts in all different sorts of currencies that you want to transact in, and then you've got a debit card which you can use, and that works perfectly well. So if you go traveling, I would use my Wise card typically. I appreciate a lot of the other banks, like Monzo has got really good rates, or Revolut has got good rates. But for example, Monzo, which would use Wise to facilitate transactions internationally. So from a spending perspective, you definitely can use it, and you know, if you go on holiday, you can have your Wise debit card. You can freeze it easily, so it's quite secure as well in that regard. And so, from a consumer perspective, I think it's quite neat. That's a far more competitive market, obviously, but they're just competing on price, convenience, and a really good simple user interface, I think.
Okay, well, I'm traveling to Europe in the next few months, so I might pick up a Wise and kick the tires on a bit of due diligence there. Okay, good. Let's turn to another one in the sort of payment space. We've got PCI Pal, that basically does sort of secure payments, largely used traditionally out of call centers to make sure that with card, not present sort of transactions, to make sure that it's properly secured without the that three-digit number at the back of a credit card. How are you seeing this one going forward?
Yeah, that's one we originally got involved with our venture capital trusts, I think in 2016. I remember meeting the business, and at the time they had a contact center business which they sold and then focused on building PCI Pal, which is essentially a pure SaaS product, which is fully cloud hosted, which is typically not the case. These softwares were sold. And they have grown from very little revenues to now about 15 million ARR, which is really, really a big, if you look at the 5-year CAGR, it's really, really, really impressive, yeah. I think. All done organically and all done through winning great partnerships in this business. They went through quite tough times with a court case, a patent court case that a competitor started against them, which they won in the UK, sort of flying colors, and settled in the US. So a big win, I think, for PCI Pal there. And so we're now at a point where this company has got its complete partner network installed. So everyone from Gamma, that a lot of your UK investors will know, to Zoom and Ring Central, 8x8, you name it, all partners. I think as a platform, it's much easier to integrate. It's got significant scale advantages in what it does. So being hosted purely on AWS, it's got great availability globally and security as a result of it. And it doesn't have that legacy tech debt that quite a few of the incumbents have, and a far better margin structure. So, you know, it's always been one where they've made progress, but it's been really had some issues. But you've got a fantastic CEO here, James. And I think they're now positioned in a really exciting point where if they can get that contract momentum going, we're looking for sort of top line growth of about 20%. I think it's completely off the radar screens. And you can put in the comparison of how Echo got taken out and what the margin dynamics and growth dynamics of Echo were and what PCI Pal's at now. And I think you will come to a conclusion that in a very consolidating industry, you've got a really, really exciting asset that should have cleared all the hurdles now, touch wood, and should be able to perform. So it's much smaller, obviously, than the other two we've talked about. But I think it's in a really good position. And great balance sheet as well. They raised some money and it should hit cash generation this year. So yeah, I think it's quite interesting. Very small, but quite interesting.
Yeah, you talked about M&A at the start, the amount of sort of private equity interest, and Bridgepoint put a number on, obviously, on Echo. And I can't remember what it was. I think it was about 3 or 4 times sales, and these trade at less than 2 times sales. And in a consolidated market, if the only operator who's available, then it makes you sort of like a scarce asset, doesn't it? So,
well, yeah, it's got far better margin dynamics than Echo, and it's got far superior growth than Echo. Now, Echo had more products, which is true, yeah. But yeah, I think they're now at a point where, I think it's the wrong price here. We'll see.
Okay, good. Well, let's go to switch sectors. Go to healthcare. We've got lots of really interesting companies to look at. Let's start with one which actually on the front foot of M&A. We've got Advanced Medical Solutions that does sort of like innovative wound care type products across the world, particularly out in the States, etc. It bought last year quite a transformational acquisition of Peters Surgical for about 140 million euros, sort of doubled the size. The shares actually have treaded water since then. How are you seeing this one going forward? It does look a very high value asset.
Yeah, I think it's one. But well, we've been investing in this since I joined the desk, I think, in 2010. Not in 2010, 10 years ago. So it's one that we sort of know intimately well, big shareholders in this company. And it's really been trading on its success of LiquidBand, which is sort of its flagship product in the US. They always had a strong cash balance, and they've always been asked to do an acquisition. Every roadshow investors would push. When are they going to do something with their money? And they've now done Peters, which we think is a really good strategic fit for the company. But over the period, there are a few things that hit sentiment in the company. So there was a big review in the US of how reimbursement is going to happen for skin substitutes. And that affected the royalty payments for one of AMS's products, which sort of dented the sentiment there. And then you've had it's a big sort of inheritance tax stock. So I think throughout that period, you also had throughout the budget, you had that dynamic as well playing into the stock. And I think investors are now sort of looking at, okay, can you deliver the synergies on Peters and can it come through? And I think that's where the question is and where essentially the opportunity persists for the valuation at this stage, because as you say, it's really not really gone anywhere. But that's going to be the defining opportunity for the company, and given that uncertainty, it creates that opportunity as you talk about. Fundamentally, I think it's quite a valuable asset. There's a scarcity of these types of assets in the UK, and it's quite well positioned. So it's I think it's an interesting one to look at and get to know at least from here.
Yeah, I mean it's a good size.
It's traditionally been trading on a much higher rate.
Yeah, it's a good size as well. 420 million market cap. I mean, you know, when you, it's sort of like pick and choose for the private equity guys and private, you know, sort of like, you know, trade buyers and this sort of stuff. And you look at it and you think, well, okay, that, that'd be a nice size for private equity to pick up or say a trade buyer.
Definitely not one we want to sell.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. Yeah, no, it's right. I mean, I've been watching it for some time because I think I think that Peter Surgical deal was fabulous. It's just, it's, you take out a lot of cost and it gives you good, you know, geographical coverage as well. So you should be able to drive sales synergies ultimately as well. But you're right; it's probably being technically sold off. Okay, let's move to stay in the same sector, but let's move down the value spectrum. We've got Ixico that Octopus became the largest shareholder, took an 18% position in the recent placing of 4 million. This is a company that does sort of like a brain scan analysis for Huntington's, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. What sort of piqued your interest on Ixico?
Well, so this is this is not held in the Future Generations Fund. It's held in our venture capital trust where we back this. We've been investors in the company for a long time. When it first went on its sort of journey to build its core platform. And essentially what it does is provide a technology platform and imaging biomarkers for big pharma and contract research organizations within the neurological disease space, which is a really, really difficult space. You know, sort of 80-90% of phase 2, phase 3 trials fail in this space. It's incredibly hard to get efficacy in those drugs. So we're talking about Huntington's disease, Alzheimer's and central nervous system diseases. So really, really hard space. And Ixico over that period of time built a really successful business in Huntington's and was a star performer really. And then one of the big phase 3 trials failed and it sort of pulled the rug under their feet. So it went through a really tough time and sort of trying to grow from there. So that is where their business was. And you've got a new CEO coming into this company now, Bram, who I think is really, really visionary in where he wants to take this company. I think he's built a great strategy as to where he wants to grow Ixico to. Diversifying in additional disease areas, so within the neurological space, and diversifying across the trial spectrum. And I think it's, from a valuation perspective, it was essentially a, sort of the enterprise value is negligible here. And for our venture capital trusts who take, you know, 5-10 year views on these assets, it was a really interesting one to back again. To go out and really try to deliver on the strategy. I mean, the IP that this company has and the strategic importance that it has is really significant. And you it would be really difficult to run some of these trials without Ixico's technology. So that's sort of the background to this one. It's a real nano micro cap. Yes. But now it's funded, it's got enough capital to go out and try to deliver on its strategy, and the proof is going to be in the pudding. So it's an interesting one.
Yeah, well, I've got a big thanks from me, because I've got one of the reasons I bought into Ixico was after your purchase, because I thought, okay, these guys will have done some serious due diligence to do 18%. So, and then I looked at it and I thought it was a terrific business. So no, thanks for that. Okay, good. Let's move to another one in the healthcare space. We've got hVIVO, which does sort of challenge trials, based down in London, highly regulated sector, helps biopharma do drug discovery for vaccines, antivirals, and treatments for, you know, infectious diseases and this sort of stuff. The shares have sold off a bit of late. How are you seeing this one going forward?
Yeah. So as you say, they do human challenge trials, which essentially is in infectious diseases. So they've got these models which cost an awful lot to develop, these disease or challenge models, which is, I think, a lot of where the value is sitting. And from a pharma perspective, human challenge trials have had very positive regulatory momentum, where regulators have looked much more favorable on the data that you collect from those trials. And what it does for pharma clients is it really cuts the time to launch or the time to fail, which is super important, because if you're spending, I mean, vaccines are really difficult in the first place as a business. And so that's why I think it's been so so positive and had such great momentum. I think the reason why the momentum has completely died has been the appointment of Robert Kennedy Jr. In America and taking over the FDA and the whole medical apparatus. He's been an outspoken critic of human challenge trials, and of course, sort of his stances on vaccines and vaccine development are quite known. So I think that's what really spooked the market, and it's just not been clear of what authority is he going to have, what is his policy agenda. You've got nothing to go on, and that creates uncertainty. And I think that's why these shares are trading where they're trading. They've confirmed that, you know, the business is performing, and, you know, these are long-term trials that they're in and contracts that they have in many cases. And so it's that space of uncertainty where I think that has created sellers of the company, right. But it's going to be interesting. I mean, we're looking a lot to the US and to what people are saying and companies are saying and what the impact might be. So even Trump has come out and sort of tampered some of the language that Bobby Kennedy had. So it's just that space of uncertainty, I think, at the moment, as to are pharma clients going to slow down their infectious disease trials or vaccine development, and are they going to change their behavior around using human challenge trials as part of their regulatory submission? So those are the two key questions, I guess. From here, I think the risk reward looks really, really, really interesting in terms of taking a position in it, it has really attractive risk reward, but that's, I think, where the shares are right now and why they are where they are.
Yeah. I heard that Robert Kennedy Jr., he didn't like vaccines, but I didn't realize he'd actually said something in terms of challenge trials. He's actually said that, as he doesn't like challenge trials.
Well, there is. Well, he hasn't said it recently, but in his past, there's been
in his past. Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
From what was?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, as you say, I mean, they're so beneficial in terms of actually developing vaccines and antivirals that they speed up the whole process. And if we hadn't have had them, then we wouldn't have got the vaccines for COVID. So it's sort of like it was a bit tough, that one.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to another one we've got. Go on.
No, sorry. I think there's a slight delay on the broadcast, hence why sometimes.
Oh, okay, sometimes no problem. Okay, well, let's move to another share, which was IPO'd earlier in 2024. It's AOT. They basically do sort of like hard to heal wounds for sort of diabetic foot and other type of ulcers that don't heal, etc. How are you seeing this one? It's got it's growing really fast, actually, and does seem to have carved itself out quite a unique position.
Yeah, it's one of the few IPOs we had last year, and we love to see IPOs and companies coming to the market and use the power of capital markets to grow. Here you've got a company that, as you say, focuses on the diabetic foot ulcer space, which is a massive space, and it's growing exponentially. And fundamentally, I think its technology is just far superior in terms of the economics, the payback for the healthcare system, and of course it reduces amputations by a large amount. It's got one of the best data sets in this space, and hence I think is quite nicely positioned to grow. So this is really a US rollout story, and selling medical devices is really difficult in the US, you need to get reimbursement. There's lots of different hurdles that you need to jump through. They've got some really, really strong initial contracts that have been sort of fueling that growth. But really the key growth story is go to different states, get reimbursement, get good list prices, and sort of grow this through the sales force. And that's essentially the story here. Superior product for a very big problem that you have, and so really driven management team, good board as well. I've got actually someone from AMS on the board as well. So I think it's nicely positioned. I think I've talked about the skin substitutes earlier, and the regulation changes in the US. I think that should be a positive for AOTI as well. I think the shares are Reg S, which means you can't buy them on hard reefs, and sort of those sorts of things. They just need to, they always take its time with these US type businesses. It's one that I think it's good that we have it on the market, and we'll see how they unlock more markets and then grow from that. Really ambitious management team.
Yeah, I think it's usually after 12 months, isn't it, the Reg S drops off, exactly, so they can then become fully listed, and then they get, because you're right, that chart says to me that the liquidity at the moment is a bit tough if you wanted to take a big position. But even though it's a sort of like a 110 million market cap type business. Yeah. Okay, yep. Good. Let's stay in the sector. Let's go to one which is, I know, is quite popular, is Diaceutics, which basically does diagnostic services for sort of rare diseases for the biopharma sector, and it helps biopharmas launch their new drugs into the market to get greater coverage and tells them which patients in a sort of like precision medicine basis are best suited to those particular drugs just through on the diagnostics. What's your sort of the flight path for this business? Because it seems to be a bit of a unique asset.
Yeah, really unique. One also we got to know through our VCTs. I remember I went to Belfast when they IPO'd, and at that point the business was still a more of a consultancy marketing services business with the idea to create a software platform and data platform. The team was run by Ryan at that time, who is now the CEO. And it was just a really ambitious plan. I mean, actually, precision medicine was not quite where it was. You didn't have yet those blockbuster drugs like Keytruda, these oncology drugs, which really, I think, really changed the game in some oncology, especially in liquid cancers. It's actually a really good book called The Beautiful Cure about this subject, as a side note. But anyway, it's so this was all really quite new, but Diaceutics was out there building, sort of seeing the issue that now you're going to have a massive flood of these drugs hitting the market, and you can only prescribe them to a very small set of patients who have a specific gene expression or would be likely to respond to the treatment. So will need to require testing, and that gap between testing and prescribing is what where they really saw that problem, and that problem that was going to arise in the future. And they were really right on that, and have proven that out. So essentially, they've built the most comprehensive data platform around testing and laboratory testing data, and can then essentially link patients getting tested to drugs to actually the drugs, so that these live saving treatments can be subscribed, which has got incredible payback for the pharma. It's got huge benefits for the patients, obviously, because they get the treatments. And I think they were just really ahead of their time in that. I think my favorite quote in investing is from James Grant, which is, brilliant investing is when everyone agrees with you later. And I think they really got that right. So now you've got a company that's got that data asset, which is ever growing. It's a competitive advantage that maintains there. you've got a scenario where several pharma companies potentially have drugs in or precision medicines within this space. So you can't afford not to have diaceutics. And I think for them going forward, it's going to be around actually getting the value that they're delivering, because the paybacks are so immense, because these are very expensive treatments. I mean, so they've got some case studies where pharma have 100 times, more than 100 times ROI for every £1 they spend on diaceutics to get £100 back, which is absolutely incredible. So that's obviously their best case, but still, it really shows that dynamic. And, you know, really strong balance sheet, even though they've just gone through a big investment program and have heavily invested in the AI on their platform. We actually did a webinar on AI, and the head of AI development was a guest speaker on there. So if people are really interested, they can hopefully check that out on our website. And, you know, strong margins. And I think it's exposed to this mega trend of precision medicine in a really attractive way. So one we really like, and I've got a soft spot for.
Who do they compete against, Dominic? Is it the CROs?
It's big CROs which are in this space as well, but no one is quite as good as at diaceutics in the coverage of the lab network, and then the connection between the medical record and the test, which is really difficult to do in the right way, and to also, you know, keep in within the limits of data compliance, and so that's essentially where I think their competitive advantage is, and. This is just a space as well where, you know, the sums are so big. You know, treatment like that could easily cost $500,000 a year in the US. And so if you find 2-3 additional patients, you know, you're making another $1.5 million. It's that sort of dynamics. And often, you know, these patients are really hard to find. Because, you know, they have a rare genetic mutation or something like that, which means they would have that disease or would be eligible for that precision medicine. And so I think, yeah, it's quite an interesting space.
Yeah, it's only going to get more popular, I think, for treatments of rare diseases and, say, unique sort of genetic conditions. I mean, you've got gene editing just starting off, and that's got a huge sort of time horizon associated with it. Okay, let's switch sectors. Let's go stay in tech, but let's go to sort of like IT tech and software tech. And one company that you own that's done really well is the low-cost computing business, Raspberry Pi, and the shares. First of all, can you just take me through the thesis? But equally, can you take me through what's happened to the stock over the last month? It's just rocketed.
One thing I know and one thing I don't know. So, Raspberry Pi, I think it's a British iconic brand, truly is.
Yeah.
Started out as a education charity and still fulfills that purpose. Building completely vertically integrated low cost computers to help teach children to code and bring the power of computing across the world, which is really exciting. And then it became very strong in the hobbyist community. So I've had a Raspberry Pi for years at home running, and it's been absolutely brilliant for that. It's 24/7 running, and you can have it in your own home, super cheap to run. So it's been massive. So you've got that community around it as well, which is really, really powerful. And then going from the hobbyist and DIY community, it then went into industrial clients where it helps automate in a lot of factories the processes. So putting a small Raspberry Pi 5 on there is super cheap for these, and that's where I think the company has had significant success. Raspberry Pi then went through a tricky pandemic where it sort of had to prioritize industrial versus hobbyist community and prioritized industrial to some extent, which really upset the community. And at that time, I remember I had to buy one on eBay for 4 times markup, which was quite
funny. I see.
There's no second best. Fundamentally, I believe that the community, so if you look at the analysts, they really think that the growth is going to come from the industrial segment in terms of selling the boards. And I think that's going to be true, but I also think that the consumer is going to come back significantly and grow again. So I think the market is not saturated. And as they get just more powerful and more powerful as they are, I mean, they are incredibly powerful for how small they are. I think that's where sort of our view is slightly different from the consensus over the long term. Now, the shares have absolutely rocketed, as you said, recently, and it looks like there's just been sellers. Have been buyers of it, which have driven those shares up. There's a certain scarcity value to it, and that full integration is going to be really difficult to compete against. But they're cheap computers from Banana Pie or, you know, from China, but they're not have that software, the security, they've not got the sort of community around it, which is really valuable as well, I think. And if you are a company, you know, automating your factory or you know, building that out, I think you're going to go with a more established, well, you're going to go with Raspberry Pi, I think. So that's sort of the background to it. I can't talk to sort of the massive rise the shares have had. It's been surprising.
Well, we got
involved at IPO, and it's been a great success since then.
Yeah, well done. It looks to me like the chart that, you know, the last couple of months has either just launched an AI product, or alternatively, somebody's looking to buy it as a, like, you know, take it out. There's been a flood of US investors coming into it, and they love it for some reason. I don't know, but I mean, it's doubled, hasn't it? Since the end of November, it's doubled, which is great news. Okay, yeah. Good. Let's move to another one in that sector. In basically, this is custom chips in Ensilica. It supplies largely sort of customer specific sort of ASIC chips for large industrial and computing applications, etc., for products. But does it? I guess the question is does it need any more money and funding to get to a greater scale? How are you seeing it?
Yeah, it's as you say, fabulous designer of chips. And when it IPO'd, it essentially was a consulting business and was trying to take over more of the value cycle of designing these chips. So whereas previously they would have handed over the design and then, you know, the economics are very different. Now they're taking chips much further down and even do the supply contract. But what that does is it's far more attractive. But it's a really difficult working capital business. So that's, I think, the perennial trickiness with this company, because growth often means additional capital requirement. And I think the management team is very aware of that. They've really, I think, grasped that. And the way they're structuring their contracts lately is really a focus on that working capital. Which I think is absolutely crucial, because fundamentally you need to be able to grow your business, which is sort of all the point that I made around you know, value creating growth that we're looking for. And that is essentially the question for this company, is can they structure these contracts in the right way? The benefit of it is, of course, that as they get more chips in production and in the pipeline, so they've got four now in production, the revenues are coming in from the production revenues are coming in, which are at attractive margins, and so it might have to bridge that gap over time. But fundamentally, I think it's in a really interesting position, because the case for ASICs, I think, has never been better, because they improve performance so significantly, the energy performance, and they are very good in terms of designing, especially in the connectivity space, ASICs. So, yeah, as you say, it's got the pipeline, it's got the contracts. Now it's about execution and managing and working capital really tightly to sort of allow for that growth, but at the same time, time, not require another funding event.
I mean, the PE is only about 9 times, so that says to me is that they're very, very cheap and for this high quality type business. And as you say, ASIC chips are absolutely flying off the shelves in terms of, just look at Broadcom in the AI space. Admittedly, this is a slightly different sector, but even so, it's customized chips. So yeah, they're doing something very valuable. And
yeah, it's a good point, because they're not going to compete for capacity with AI chips in terms of in the foundries like TSMC or so, because they are different wavelengths. So they should not be struggling around supply for these. In fact, they are a really good customer for TSMC, and as they get more chips in production, they become a bigger and bigger customer of TSMC. I think that's a really good point. So people always think, oh, there's a big chip shortage, and Facebook and OpenAI buy all the chips there are, but obviously they're very, very different.
What they try to achieve. Okay, good. Let's finish off the sort of tech sector with a bit of software stock. Cerebras Technologies does software and services for sort of data analysis, and it helps corporates on the fraud detection to identify whether there's illicit payments going through and illicit purchases, but also on the marketing to see whether what the best response rates are for adverts and this sort of stuff. The shares have come back quite a lot of just of late. How are you seeing the business moving forward?
Yeah, it's a company that has gone through a transition under a completely new management team over the last few years, and moving to high proportion of software revenues. Now you've got about 20 million of ARR there, and that's growing 20%. So that bit alone, I think, is quite valuable in what they're doing. But of course, they still have parts of their business which are relatively lumpy, and that's always that difficulty that it creates. I think they've got fantastic traction within the financial services space, where their fraud capability is quite unmatched in what they're doing, and they've started going into other segments as well, other verticals. And as you win one client, it becomes a lot easier to win the next client, given you've got the case studies and what you're trying to achieve. Now, it's worth to go to their website and look at all of the different clients that they've won. So it's in that space. It's as always a company going through transition. I think their accounting is really quite conservative as well, if you compare it to US style accounting, I'd say, than UK style accounting for software companies. So that hits the EBITDA there as well. But
they don't just on that, Dominic. Do you mean basically they don't capitalize their R&D?
Yeah, exactly. They're expensive. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think it's fundamentally, it always has a weird H1, H2 split, so it always looks scary at the interims. And the question is always, can they climb the mountain to hit the full year? And I think that's why the shares have come back a bit, just because, when you have an H1, H2 split that looks quite like that, you're like, oh, people are a little bit more worried. But in the long term, I think they're really nicely positioned. Their platforms are deployed all over the world successfully. They're getting very strong ROI for where they are, and I think their sales force is humming. So it's an interesting one, it's a revenue transformation and then a margin expansion story, because as more software revenues and pure software revenues, SaaS revenues come on, the margin should improve as well. That's sort of where they're sitting.
I would agree, and it's not expensive. It's 1.5 times sales, and it wouldn't. wouldn't be out of this world that somebody say buys this, because I mean there's so many software companies being taken out as well at some point in time. Okay, that's fabulous.
Got a good balance as well, so some cash on there as well.
Yeah, well, we don't normally cover that one at all, so that's great. Okay, well, let's move to another sector. We've got plant-based specialty polymers company, Itaconics, is it? And basically, they help sort of consumer products and packaging, presumably, to have more environmentally friendly products rather than sort of like petroleum-based or carbon-based, because it's plant-based. How are you seeing this one? What sort of piqued your interest here?
So this is one we first got involved with our microcap fund and then the VCTs later. So one we've known for quite a long time as well. It's, as you say, they're making performance ingredients for FMCG applications. So dishwasher tablets is actually the space that they're in.
So it's not packaging, it's actually ingredients.
It's actually functional ingredients. And in that, I think, is the sort of interesting point, because the way you compete in this space is by having better costs, as a cost advantage and performance advantage. So these companies don't buy really on the sustainability credentials, is the truth. They really buy on performance and the cost advantage. So itaconic acid and the chemistry that Itaconics has, it is natural and has great sustainability and all these nice things that you talked about, but also it can deliver superior performance at lower cost. And that's really where this is, I think, a really exciting case, because it solves that problem at an interesting position. So the reason the shares have underperformed is they've had a very big customer which was at a low margin business, and essentially they decided to part ways with that customer, which is always a painful process when a company is still relatively small and you lose a very big customer, even though it was at a low margin and really didn't hit the earnings profile. Still, you know, to rip junk out of your top line is quite painful. So that's what they're going through at the moment. And that's reflected in its market cap. I mean, there's some US sort of competitors which are valued much, much higher with much less progress. And it's sort of just completely off the radar screens as a result. They're still going to do $10 million of sales. And I think the market cap is about $20 million in sales. Mm. So, I think doing all the right things and improving the quality of the business, but going through sort of that painful transition at the moment. In terms of our future generations fund, it's got that, you know, really solving an important problem. It's got really nice sustainability credentials, but much more importantly, I think in the long term, it's got a business model that really can work, because it's outcompeting the existing technologies in that space. And so that's sort of the background to this one. Yeah. It's an interesting one, but as you say, quite small and a little bit of a special satellite at the moment.
Yeah, it was really interesting that, because I'd never appreciate. I always thought it was sort of like a plant-based packaging, which is wrong. It's actually functional ingredients that help basically improve the performance and reduce the cost. And yes, it has that sustainability angle, but it's all functional ingredients. So yeah, that's terrific. I'll have a good look at that. Thanks very much. Okay, let's move to the energy transition. Let's go to a couple of well-known stocks to start a bit big. We've got Ceres Power, which is really one of the poster childs of the sort of hydrogen transition, producing and converting green hydrogen into electricity. They really do seem to be shifting that top line. But I guess the question finally comes down to is, when do you think they're going to be profitable? Because they're forecast to, as I see, to make about 60 million pounds of turnover there, but they're still not profitable, which seems a bit weird, perfectly honest.
Yeah, they do know how to spend money, I think. Very strong R&D.
Politely put.
Capacity. No, I think the hydrogen space went through a proper hype cycle. Mm. Of the digital transitions. We did so much work in that space, got to know all the technologies. Octopus Energy actually has had a hydrogen business as well, so it's very useful to call upon the experts from that side of the business. And ultimately, I think where Ceres Power has been, from the business model perspective, has been really good is focusing on being asset light, having the leading technology. They obviously bet on solid oxide as opposed to PEM or alkaline cells, and have had really good tractions with their fuel cells in licensing those with Bosch and others. Now, lots of stop starts in China, which is always really quite difficult. But as you say, really quite strong. So I think the question for this one is going to be how strong is the adoption of hydrogen going to be? Because ultimately, it is a bit of a network effect, right? Because if you have an infrastructure for hydrogen, you then have a need for a fuel cell. And then that is sort of that dynamic. And it's really hard to build up. And I think a lot of governments really want hydrogen to happen. I mean, the EU is pushing, the targets are crazy in terms of, you look at the gigawatts that they want to get in terms of electrolyzer capacity. And the question is going to be how strong is that demand going to be and that push going to be. And I think we've gone through sort of a sort of trough in terms of sentiment here, where people just thought, okay, well, hydrogen's just completely dead, it's just not going to happen. And where previously we thought everything's going to be hydrogen and your car's going to drive hydrogen. So, and I think the truth is probably going to be somewhere in the middle. And I think if it is somewhere in the middle, Ceres is still positioned really, really nicely. And so again, really IP heavy business, obviously, and it's got some good, really good customers. But yeah, it's been far from where it used to be in terms of its market cap, as you say.
Yeah.
As it has gone through that hype cycle.
Yeah, I saw the latest note actually from Panmure Liberum, and their target price compared to £1.80 where it currently lies, their target price is £7. So, I mean, it's significantly higher. It makes 80% gross margins, and it's obviously an asset light. And that's the head scratcher to me. I haven't yet got my head around why if they make 60 million a turnover, what's their cost base? Is it all R&D and sales, is it, or something? I mean, it just seems enormous that they've got a lot of IPR.
A lot of it is R&D. Yeah, a lot of it is R&D. And the truth is, it's like, it is very hard, these things. Like, that's one thing I think I've really learned in this space. It's like moving these fuel cells and electrolyzers from technology readiness of 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 is so hard. It's so difficult, actually. It's not like programming a new website. It is really difficult chemistry. It's cutting edge chemistry. Yeah, okay. And I think it's very hard to just grasp just how difficult it is to move this forward. And I mean, that's a lesson I've learned time and time again in investing in this space. It's going to take so much longer than you think, and it's going to be so much harder. And it's not a given that these chemistries will work.
Yeah,
well, I mean, fuel cells have been around forever, really, but making them commercial and making them useful has been really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think the great thing about your type of portfolio is that you choose a whole lot of companies that have got real scalable, high margin characteristics. And yes, clearly some of them are going to take longer and they're going to cost twice as much and all this sort of stuff, and some of them will fail. But overall, the ones who actually do hit the ball out of the park, they more than pay for everything else. And so you just got to accept that when you go early stage businesses, you're going to be wrong a lot of the time. But it's the ones which come good that you really, so the portfolio as a whole really do move the dial.
No, exactly. And of course, these would be very small satellite positions for us. Where they are in the funds, so the exposure is quite limited. Right. But of course, we then have them on the pad. We can pull the trigger if the momentum is changing. And so that's sort of a benefit in that. But yeah, as you say, all the ones that sort of Atacconics is serious, they're more on the definitely on the satellites side.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's finish off on the on one again in sort of energy transition. It's Invinity Energy Systems. They basically do vanadium, grid-scale batteries that are helping the transition to basically create battery farms. How are you seeing this one? Again, it's a bit, the chart's a bit similar to Ceres Power.
Yeah, it's so I think, well, so Invinity is trying to solve the issue that lithium ion cells have. So currently, if you have a solar farm, you do need energy storage, and yes, there's an established business model using lithium ion, but lithium ion has drawbacks in terms of longer term storage, it's really difficult, and of course they degrade really, really hard. I mean, that's why you buy an iPhone every 2 years because these batteries are just bad. So they are using a chemistry based on vanadium flow, and that chemistry really looks like it has far superior characteristics for longer term energy storage. So that's where it could be. It's also got real world data. So this is not just in the lab, but they've got these batteries running out in the world, and you've sort of got 20 million of sales. They've got really good partnerships with Siemens Gamesa, which has just been sold actually, but to develop the next generation battery. And the process that I talked about earlier, from moving from one generation to the next and technology readiness to the next, they have done quite well. It's not been without its hiccups, as you can see in the chart, but fundamentally they've made really quite good progress. And recently they had a sort of large fundraising where you've had the UK Infrastructure Bank invest, which is their first listed investment, quite a significant strategic investors as well. So at a point where their fund, so the thesis is you've got a business now which really does seem to address a problem in the market, and it's far superior to vanadium flow. The technology roadmap and the next technologies look to be quite promising in what they can achieve, and you've got a decent funding and backer environment, so that's where they are. Now it's really going to be about, you know, are people going to buy these batteries, and are you going to get an institutionalize these batteries for renewable energy projects, and that's going to be the key question. That's quite interesting, but yeah, a little satellite in there, quite interesting, but yeah, it's still very much to prove, I think it's fair to say.
Okay, good. Well, something to stick on the stopwatch, and we'll see how it progresses. Okay, I've got a tough question here for you, Dominic. Given all the ones we've gone through and any others you have, what's your sort of the stock for 2025 that sort of is most exciting for you, that has got sort of like gets the pulse sort of racing along?
Oh, that's a good question, Matt. Well, I'll give you a couple. I'll give you two.
Yeah, please do.
I think Boku, we touched on, I think it's just really well positioned. And as you said, you've got the Amazon contract coming through, and just the dynamics of that one. I'm quite excited about it. It's really hard to pick, but I'll throw that one out. I think given where they're positioned and its value, I think I'll put that one on the pad. And then I'll give you a bit of a wild card, just because you mentioned gene editing and cell therapy is this business that sort of I followed since IPO. It's a company called MaxCyte.
Oh, yes.
Okay, yeah. So MaxCyte, they're now dual listed on NASDAQ. They raised a whole lot of money on NASDAQ. But you've got about 200 million of cash on the balance sheet and about 250 million market cap. You've got about 40 million of recurring revenues, selling essentially machines, these flow electroporation machines, which essentially allow you to deliver gene edited or cell treatments. So that's it, as opposed to using a technology like viruses, like you would be so know from Oxford Biomedica, for example. So it's a competing technology fundamentally. Now, it's a good, I think that the core business is quite good, but it's also a business that knows how to spend money quite well, to put it that way. But what I think is really interesting about it is that they've got 29 strategic platform partners. So these are drug companies which use this technology in their treatments, and they're at various stages in the clinical life cycle. So every time a company progresses, they will get a milestone payment across that, from going from phase two to phase three and so on and so on. They've also got the very first treatment now, which has been approved and is in the market, which is the Vertex sickle cell treatment.
Yes.
And that is going to start really selling, and royalties are going to start coming through. So you've got that massive pipeline of potential drugs that are going to enter or hit the market. So in a way, it's sort of a call option on the cell therapy space. Mm. And I think it's just really interestingly positioned. Now, it's always going to be the question when that flood really comes, how well is Vertex going to do? But fundamentally, where the balance sheet is, how I see the core business, I just think it's such an attractive asset. And it's just valued at very little relative to I think, what it does. And, you've got the Danaher's, the Lonza's of these worlds, which I think it would be really interesting for them. So that is my wild card. I just find it really interesting. I've been following it since the start. So I really, really like it. I think it's quite interesting. So I'll leave you with Brockhead and Maxite for 2024.
Going to finish on Maxite. I mean, they've got that exploration. Basically, they help the gene edited active sort of drug, etc., to go into from the lab into the individual. Don't they get that sort of the gene edited part of the DNA into a particular cell that then can in the lab that then can then get put into the individual later on? But you're right, having actual real demonstrated proof with the only sort of drug which is gene editing, which is out in the market, that sickle cell for Vertex is a tremendous sort of pat on the back for their technology.
And also, just as I said, like these 29 strategic partners that they use, they won't be able to switch. So you can't switch because it's part of your regulatory submission. So once you choose a technology to do that, you can't switch. So it's fundamentally baked into the future. So of course, of these 29, some trials will fail, of course. But I mean, the theory is that gene editing and precision medicines will have far higher approval rates than other medicines. So that's the sort of the thesis. And then you're baked in. I mean, you can't switch. I mean, Vertex, it would be virtually impossible for them to use a different methodology without going through incredible regulatory hassle and potential additional studies. So that's why I think it's quite interesting. And I think strategic investors will look at that and say, well, you've got that massive pipeline, and in 5 years' time, you'll have 15 approved therapies and getting royalties from 15 therapies. And so that's the exciting, exciting sort of long-term vision for that one.
No, I would agree. Fabulous choices. Okay, well, thanks very much, Dominic, for all those insights and stock ideas that people can run their slider all over for later this year. I would like to say again a big thanks to our sponsorship, Capes Keeps the Lights On. And if you want to have a good look at that report on Boku, then it's on the Edison website. You can just download it there. And I strongly suggest people have a look at that because it covers all of that Amazon Japan deal as well, so that's really helpful. But thanks, guys, for your questions, and very much looking forward in touching base in 6 months' time, Dominic. So thanks again.
Thank you so much. It was really good fun.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.